Thank you, everyone. Good afternoon. I know it's been a long session, so I'll try and be as short as possible and have as many pretty pictures as I can. My name is Russell Power. I'm a graduate student at New York University. I'm going to talk about Piccolo, which, as we just heard, is a system for distributed computing. It's something I've been working on with my advisor, Jin-Yang Li. So let me just start. I'll jump right in with an example, and this is going to be something I'm going to motivate us through the entire thing with. So this is a very simplified algorithm that we might use for PageRank, where PageRank, I think most of you guys should be familiar with, we have some kind of graph with a set of nodes, and for each node, we want to take the outgoing edges and propagate some rank amongst them. So for each iteration of PageRank, we propagate some rank from node to node, and we just repeat this process until we reach some kind of convergence. So this algorithm that we're doing has some data associated with it. Naturally, there's going to be some kind of input graph, which is presumably fixed. And then in this case, I have these cur and next tables, which we're going to swap each iteration as we sort of accumulate values. And as iterations go along, we'll go ahead and fill in values. They'll get updated. We'll fill them in. We'll get updated. And the important thing to note is that the only mutating part of this, the only part that's changing, are these cur and next tables. And for PageRank and many other problems that we're interested in, this actually fits in memory quite easily. So, for example, let's say if we had 10 billion pages, this would be maybe 100 gigabytes of memory, which is still very easily available on, say, 10 or 100 machines. So there's obviously a lot of systems for doing this. I'm going to go over briefly a couple of existing approaches that we might use for something like PageRank. One that I'm sure you guys have heard about is called MapReduce. So MapReduce and Dryad and all these data flow models don't actually expose this global state. So they don't, those tables that I was talking about being modified aren't actively visible, right? As a user, I instead supply an operator, which is working on a little bit of data at a time. But this leads to the question, well, if I can't actually see the global state, then how do I compute my values? And it turns out, like every answer, we say out of band. So we have some distributed storage, and MapReduce case is almost always GFS or Hadoop HDFS. We have our graph. We have our rank values on that. We're going to stream them in. We're going to have our operator be applied. The computation will go ahead. We'll do our map. We'll do our reduce. They'll do some communication with each other. And then we'll write it back. So this is the process. So for each iteration, we then go ahead and do the same thing. We're going to read in a graph. Whoops. There we go. Read in a graph and some ranks, do a process, and then write it back. So each iteration, we're communicating and writing to this distributed storage. And this is how we actually maintain state between iterations. And it's important to note that this works, but it's not ideal for every situation. We can't access that state between iterations. This is a one-time thing. We write it and we read it in the beginning at the end. And also, it's not necessarily the fastest access that we could possibly hope for. So another way we might implement this would be with MPI, or for those who don't know about MPI, would be like an RPC layer where I explicitly, as a programmer, control the communication and I do everything myself. Here I have my three workers. We want to read in from our distributed storage. Now here, as an application programmer, I've gone and explicitly decided how I want to divide up my graphs. So I go ahead and read them to all our machines. Once they're read, now we can say, well, I have some ranks associated with those. And now again, I have to explicitly decide how to communicate between these machines to actually perform my algorithm. And this works. It's just really hard. The reason why people don't use hard-coded RPCs themselves and instead use MapReduce is because it's really difficult and annoying. So what we'd like would be some way we could access the state, but do it efficiently and not have to deal with all that communication ourselves. So there we go. So our goal as a model is to expose this state in a useful form for the programmer, but still allow it not to be an explicit communication. So we need to have some kind of state which we'll load our graph data into, we'll load our ranks into, and then I, as a programmer, conceptually, I'm just going to interact with this state rather than explicitly communicating between machines. So I, as a programmer, don't have to think about these things. So this brings with it natural decomposition. That conceptual bubble that I mentioned earlier, obviously we have to divide somehow into parts just like before. We also have to have some bubble for how our ranks are held. But now this communication and this division can be done by the runtime. Instead of explicitly doing so, I'm just going to let the runtime sort of handle things for me. Now anytime we say that, well, it's like, it's sure, it could be easy to use, it could be nice and look at that pretty bubble. This always runs into problems when we try and combine this with something that's actually performant. So here's my visualization of what normally happens. We have my ease of use car and my performance car, and darn it, they were going the wrong direction. We're trying to do something a little better. Instead, I think we achieved the Chevy El Camino, which is the glorious car truck of years past, which was never appreciated as much as it should have been. But I think it exemplifies exactly me and this project. So, okay. So a little bit about our model. So we talked about having this shared state. We have this cloud. Everybody's interacting with this cloud. There's a lot of decisions we have to make about how to access this state. So like I said, we want to have this performance. We want to have it ease of use. So we need to figure out some way of choosing our model. We need to choose how we want to represent this state so that it's both easy to use and effective in terms of performance. So there's a lot of ways we could do this. We could simply have a gigantic array that was exposed to all the machines. So this would be very much like distributed shared memory. Or at the other side of things, we might have a almost like a SQL table with lots of columns and types and everything. And one key thing that we found is it's important to choose the right level of abstraction. So like I said, we could have this read-write level where you're just loading and storing directly out of memory. And we've actually found that that doesn't serve us very well. We need, in order to actually have an efficient computing system, we need the application programmer's help because we're not smart enough to do it ourselves. And if we have the too low-level interface, they can't actually help us. So we have to X that out. And I'll explain in a little while why we need these why we need this help and how we can make use of it. So instead, what we found is a viable solution is instead a simple key value interface. So we have some keys of some type and a value of some type, and the normal sort of get, put, and iteration primitives that you would expect on this kind of table. So that's a rough idea of the model. Let me show you what it would look like to implement something with this, given that it's still ill-specified. We've implemented this as a library for C++ and Python. So I'm going to give you some pseudocode that looks like Python, but don't be too afraid. So what do we need? Well, we need to define some tables. So this is just those tables that we saw earlier. We have some table for this to read from and table to write to. And it has some key that points. I'm going to talk about web pages here, so I'm going to identify them by page IDs. And the value is just some rank value. So those are our tables. We're going to have some kind of controller function, and you don't have to worry too much about the code here, but basically we're going to run 50 iterations of some process. Each iteration is going to actually do that page rank computation, and this controller is just kind of running things along one by one by one. So it's going to launch these jobs. Each job is just some subset of work. So the controller is a single thread that's just executing once, but we need some way to access the tables and do so in parallel. So this launch jobs is just our primitive of doing so, and it's just saying run a lot of jobs on all the machines I have. What does each job do? Well, it does the very straightforward thing. It takes a piece of the graph, and then almost this is a direct transliteration of what we saw earlier. It takes that piece of the graph, it takes each node, and then it looks along each edge and applies that rank. So it's just adding that rank along. So this looks really easy. Well, at least to me, this looks very easy. And if this was it, then I wouldn't have a very long talk. Fortunately, there are a few problems that we have to adjust. So let's look at what the communication between machines looks like in this situation. So as we saw before, we're just picking some random part of the graph and some random part of the ranks, and we're kind of grabbing stuff from everywhere. So we have a lot of reads. We have a lot of gets from every machine and a lot of puts for every machine. So here I'm just showing the reads and writes from machine one. But it has to do gets from remote machines. And reading those remote machine state is expensive. It takes a while. We want to try and avoid that if we can. And likewise, if we can avoid doing remote puts, that's great. We want to reduce these and try and emphasize as many local accesses as possible. So to do so, we're gonna need to somehow exploit the locality that's existent in this problem. And the way we do so is we let the user tell us. So the user, as a programmer, is going to just simply indicate, and I'm going to show you on the code on the next slide here, we just need to make some tiny modifications to our code to actually make use of the locality intrinsic in this problem. So rather than having some vague definition of a table, let's just choose some number of partitions. And here I'm going to say I want to explicitly partition them based on websites. This is just semantically convenient. And also, websites tend to link internally to themselves more often than not, so it avoids writing outside of a machine. And the guarantee provided by the framework is that a partition can go anywhere, but a partition is local, will always be local to a single machine. So the application programmer can rely on that. Also, we want to make sure that the tables, each partition of a table is aligned with one another just to avoid doing any excess writes if we don't have to. And we're going to tell the kernels that we want them to actually run local to the data that they're using. So this is all pretty pretty reasonable. And we can see how this changes our access graph. Our sloth hopefully now will have gone away. Oh, yes, he did. Good. We've rearranged our data because now we've explicitly said, well, we want to put the sites together. We want to have things arranged properly. And oh, wow, look at that. So now our gets inputs are definitely much, much more strongly associated with the local machine. So we're not quite done yet. We still have this issue. We still have these lingering puts that we see. The real problem comes when they're inverted. So when we have two writers who are trying to collide, so both these writers have of update values that they want to apply, what happens? Well, in the current situation, and as I've described, we probably get a meltdown and our algorithm never actually converges. So we need to do something about this. We need to somehow handle the synchronization between these writers. We have a lot of writers, potentially. We want to make sure that we can do this correctly and efficiently. So in order to do so, we need some primitives. The way we actually do this is we need to take a step back. So our original program, we read from the current table, we added to it, and then we wrote back. And instead, we can think about, well, in the PageRank algorithm, what we really want to do is sum together a whole bunch of updates. So if instead we associate the summing with that actual summation with the table itself, we no longer have to worry about, as a user, some kind of conflict. All the updates are actually perfectly acceptable. They're just summed together. So if we just attach that as a property of the table itself, any kind of commutative function will satisfy this. And the idea of this is encapsulated as this accumulator interface, which takes an old value and an update and returns a new value. And some common ones that we've found useful are sum, product, min, and max. Once we can associate our tables with these accumulation functions, we've actually found that global barriers are sufficient. We don't actually need to have pairwise locking between machines, which is great because that's really slow and we want to avoid it. Also, we're explicitly now just going to give some consistency semantics for the table. So we're just going to say they provide release consistency, which in this case means we're going to guarantee that these accumulations are atomic. But the tables can be buffered as long as the system desires, except they're guaranteed at barriers. So at barriers, all those accumulations have to be applied to the final value. So anytime I do a barrier, I can be guaranteed that all those updates have been applied. So that sounded like a lot, I know. But let's see what changed in the actual code. Like, how does this actually modify what we have to do? And it turns out it's not very complicated. What do you know? We tell our tables to simply accumulate via sum. This is pretty straightforward. So as they receive updates, we want them just to add them together. And in addition, in our user code, we've changed it. Rather than reading the current value and adding it together and applying it, we're just going to add this update directly. So we're just giving the new value, which is going to be accumulated then by the table and the runtime itself. And also, we're just going to explicitly invoke this barrier between iterations. So that way, we know after each iteration, the values have all been propagated, and we can go ahead and swap. So we can see how this changes our little communication pattern here. Before, we had these puts. These puts can conflict. We don't know what to do with these writes to this table cell A. But now we've changed them to updates, and updates are very easy. We know what to do with updates. We just add them together. So at the remote host, we simply compute the sum, and that's a new value of the table cell. And no matter how many incoming updates we have, this is very easy for us to do. Also, the fact that we're using this release consistency, workers can buffer the remote writes as long as they need to in order to wait for network capacity, which means that writes are actually quite fast. We don't have to block any computation while waiting for writes to be propagated. So we're not quite done yet because, as my friend the server failure cat is indicating, we haven't actually done anything to make this robust. So we need to provide some way for the user to actually make something work when something bad happens, like the server crashed. So what do we do? Well, let's go back to the code. I mean, we need to somehow provide some way of indicating how we're going to save and restore the state that we have. So what do? We take that barrier that we had before that was simply block and wait for the tables to propagate. And instead, we're going to change it to a checkpoint barrier. And what does this do? The system, once a checkpoint barrier is done, it's going to guarantee that whatever table data we asked it to store and any user data we asked it to store is going to be consistently written to disk and available for restoration. And then when we start back up, we just have to check for any previous checkpoint data and restore if we need to. So in PageRank's case, this is very simple. We just write out a checkpoint, read it if we want. So we can see sort of what this looks like as we write out the ranks. The graph itself, of course, is a static feature, so we're not going to have to checkpoint that every time we have some kind of checkpoint. Implementation-wise, we use the Chandy-Lamport protocol, which is a non-blocking protocol. So it's very useful for us because we can actually checkpoint long-running computations without having to wait for any synchronization point. So I don't think I have enough time to go through the whole runtime. I just want to talk a little bit about one particular area which is important for us, which is the scheduling and load balancing that we have to do. So every system is going to have some kind of load balancing issues. I think we just heard about 20 in this very session. So we have our own. Ours are complicated by the fact that we decided to maintain state. If you have something like MapReduce, you can simply start a new task and that's it because they're stateless. We don't have that advantage, so we have to go and make sure that we can still make good use of our machines. So in this case, we have a master which is running that controller thread that we saw earlier in our PageRank code. We've decided to run some jobs, and we have some partitions scheduled, partitions of the data scheduled with them. And here we see that, worker one has run out of something, run out of stuff to do. So we'd ideally like to steal some work from someone else. The master can go ahead and coordinate this. Unfortunately, this is non-trivial because we want to respect those locality constraints that we put forth in the table originally. If we violate those, then we go ahead and give up on all the hard work that we did setting up those constraints in the first place. So we need to make sure we migrate any partitions of the table that are needed by that job. So here I'm showing partition 6. I want to steal job 6, so let's move partition 6. But even that's a little harder than we want because it turns out lots of people might be updating that partition at the same time we're trying to write it. And here we're actually rescued by our use of release consistency. We can simply buffer and pause all updates to that partition until the new worker has a consistent mirror. And once that partition has been mirrored, now it's very easy. Now it's very straightforward to actually go ahead and move the new job over and apply all the buffered updates. So some quick evaluation numbers. We ran some comparisons against Hadoop for PageRank and K-means. This is for PageRank. I left out the K-means because it's not as interesting and it would fill things up. So this is on our local cluster of 64 cores. You can tell we're significantly faster than Hadoop, and that the scaling here is pretty reasonable. And it's important to note that at the tail end here, at the 64 node case, we're actually finishing iterations in around 8 seconds. So things like overhead. So when we look at the overhead from the actual Hadoop run, things like HDFS are actually significant costs of time. The main cost in Hadoop is the actual sorting, which is necessary in order to do joins effectively. In addition, we don't have to serialize nearly as much because any local updates are simply applied directly into the local state. So we can also see sort of how this scales up. This is some tests we did on EC2. It's, again, running PageRank. This time, we've just scaled the amount of data that we have in proportion with the number of workers. So an ideal scaling would be something like a linear line. And as you can tell, it's pretty close. There's not too much to get out of this other than at the high end, we're running on around a billion nodes, and it's and with 200 workers, it takes about 68 seconds. So this is to my knowledge one of the fastest runs that we know of. So we also implemented a few other applications. These we don't have comparisons with Hadoop on. They aren't really strictly implementable in a data flow model in any straightforward way. Things like the asynchronous applications that I'm talking about here as a distributed web crawler is something where you never actually have a global barrier. You're just continually polling the state of a table over and over and over in order to access your sort of current edges of the web graph. And so without that kind of barrier, then there's no logical way of actually implementing this directly in something like Hadoop. Obviously, there's a lot of work in this area. The data flow models that are very popular right now are MapReduce and Dryad. They're great for certain kinds of disk-intensive and streaming-intensive processing. But like I was saying, that lack of that shared state can be a negative in some cases. Also, in the past, there have been things like tuple spaces with Lynda. Those was in the 80s. But these were not really designed for any kind of computing process. They were more for communication. So they don't have any notion of locality or accumulation that you would need to make efficient use of actual computing resources. And of course, there's distributed shared memory, the original papers, and also more recently, there are partition versions. And what we've found is that the low-level access, that load-store interface that distributed shared memory provides, is a little too low in order to actually make use of some of those hints, which I was talking about earlier. So what do we provide? We provide this distributed shared table model, and we have simple and useful policies for using locality, for synchronization, and for failure recovery. And I can take any questions.
What is your fallback strategy for dealing with computations that don't fit easily into a commutative aggregate function?
In our experience, we actually we've found relatively few. What we've found is that for all the applications we've looked at, you can generally push it into a commutative function if necessary. If there ends up being like a larger class of applications that I've simply spaced out on, I think you would have to end up relying on some kind of pairwise locking. But again, that's slow enough that you're trying to want to avoid it at all costs. So.
Okay.
Thank you. Hi, David Greenaway from UNSW and NICTA.
Hi.
Just a clarification on your checkpointing.
Sure.
If a node fails during a computation, do you need to restart all the nodes in the cluster, or just the single node that failed from the last checkpoint?
Oh yes, good question. So there's basically you need to roll back all the nodes to the last checkpoint. So there's some careful consideration of how often you want a checkpoint in order to maximize your use of time. But yeah, the current implementation, you roll back everybody to wherever the last checkpoint was.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.